From health and wellness to education,
we need to be thinking about what it takes for students to succeed.
From art and politics to social issues of the day,
we have young Black males who are thriving in their communities and who are being shown as leaders.
The journey is what matters.
I would say to all of us, we can be better than we are.
Let's join Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, president of Howard University, and his guests as they take steps on the journey.
A historian with his facts grounded in history, but with an eye to the future. Hello, I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick, and our conversation today on the journey is with Dr. Michael Winston. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm glad to be here.
So, Dr. Winston, you were born in New York City and graduated from a famous high school, as they say. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
I went to the public schools of New York City and quite by accident learned of the existence of Stuyvesant High School, one of seven high schools in the city system that admitted by examination. One day I was on my bicycle and a perfect stranger rode up beside me and we had a very brief conversation for a few blocks. At the end of the conversation, he made the random remark, "You know, you're smart. You should go to Stuyvesant." I said, "What's that?" And he rode off. It is one of the uncanny experiences of my life. I learned that there were these schools and that your counselors at the junior high school had to recommend you. I went to the counseling office and they said they would not recommend me. They said it was too competitive and I would be unhappy there. So then I learned more about the process and discovered you could petition to take the exam, which I did. I went around and got community signatures. I was the only Black student of the 16 that year who were authorized to take the exam. And I was the only one from that junior high school that year who was admitted. It was an all-male high school, a science high school. And it was there that I learned how to do hard intellectual work.
How did you make your way from there to Howard University?
Howard University, since 1940, had the National Competitive Scholarship Program, which had been conceived by Dr. Charles H. Thompson when he was dean of the College of Liberal Arts. And each year, representatives from Howard went to the public schools noted for producing fine graduates across the country. And Dean Armour J. Blackburn of Howard came to Stuyvesant that year, spoke to us about the opportunities at Howard. That year, as it happened, my father had been laid off. And so there was no family income. My plan was to go to the City College of New York because I could go uptown for 15 cents. I just needed to buy a sandwich and then 15 cents to get back home, and I could go to that kind of college. I took the Howard exam, and then in the spring, in my shop class, which was taught by one of the counselors, he announced to the class that Michael Winston was the first student in the school to get an early scholarship, and it was from Howard University for 4 years of tuition and dormitory rent. And so all I had to do was get $30 a month for a meal ticket that would give me three meals a day. And that was how I got my college education at Howard, and one of the reasons that I am fanatically devoted to the institution.
Understood. Quite an association you had. At the time that you came to Howard University, who were the major influences on you at the time?
A transforming moment was the first time I heard the president of the university speak, Dr. Mordecai Wyatt Johnson. And he spoke to us about the purposes of higher education, which was to understand the meaning of human life and how you could be of service to those people who were the most disadvantaged on the planet. He was not talking just about the United States. And he talked of education as liberating. Once you understood things, then you had the freedom to make your own choices. I had never heard anything quite like it. I'd never seen anyone like him. You could hear a pin drop in that chapel, which was full. As I went through my undergraduate career here, I had a number of major influences after another accident. I came to Howard as a pre-med intended student. And a student in what's now Drew Hall, who's then a brand new building, didn't have a name yet, said to me, "Breeze, you ought to take a course from Harold Lewis." I didn't know who Professor Lewis was. I said, what class is that?" He said, "That's history. You just have to. It'd be a crime for you to graduate from Howard without taking that class." So I signed up for something that would fit. You know, most lower classmen will do what you tell them. And so I saw that there was a space in my program for a course called History 3A, World History to 1650. After listening to Professor Lewis for about 3 weeks, I knew that medicine was no longer in my future, that I wanted to be a historian. I wanted to study history the way he studied it. I had never encountered that kind of analysis before, and I was fascinated by it. My maternal grandfather was heartbroken. I don't think he ever really forgave me for giving up that ambition. And so every time some honor came my way, I made sure he was the first to hear about it and the first to get the evidence that I was not wasting my time.
You're listening to The Journey. My guest today is Dr. Michael Winston. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Just to switch gears a bit, you obviously were here at Howard University during your undergraduate career at a time of much change and transformation in this country. And from a personal and a historian's perspective, when you look at what is transpiring in our nation today, what are some of the similarities you see, and where do you see Howard University fitting into that context?
Well, President Frederick, as you know, Howard University has always been a place of enormous energy, and students and faculty from a wide range of backgrounds and interests. One of the things that struck me was how active the student body was, and major non-faculty influence on me were the student leaders. Timothy Jenkins was one of the leaders. He became president of the student council, but he was on the debate team. And when I heard him speak, I said, "I want to be on the debate team." So I did that. And early on, there was a group that is now largely forgotten called the Nonviolent Action Group. And it was a group that started at Howard that would go over to Virginia every weekend to protest the segregation there. And this preceded SNCC and preceded the Freedom Riders. And it was clear that Howard students wanted to make a difference. We also had many faculty who were encouraging us. One in particular in the law school was Professor James Washington, who later became an acting dean of that school, Professor Robert Martin in the political science department. But the students were very active, not only in domestic situations, but international ones, because at the time we had students from 90 countries. There was a great deal of talk about decolonization, because these students were coming from colonies. And so in my college years here, Ghana had achieved its independence the year before I came to Howard. And then when I was a sophomore, Nigeria was independent. And of course, President Ezekwe had been a Howard student. So there was a good deal of intellectual as well as active work connected with desegregation and decolonization. my cohort at Howard was really on the cusp just before the most active protest, the Greensboro sit-ins, was 1960. So that came right in the middle of my college years. And soon after our cohort left, as the society began to desegregate more rapidly, opportunities opened up for more students. And so some of the energy went into other directions. And then, of course, after I graduated, went to graduate school, and came back as a faculty member, things were still not that different from what they had been when I was a student. But by 1966, 67, 68, there was a different kind of activism on the campus. And Howard was one of the most activist campuses in the country, with Columbia and Berkeley being the other notables.
Mm-hmm. And today, do you see the student body with that same type of activism, or do you think that they are expressing themselves in a different manner?
I see the energy, the urge to make a positive difference. Their reaction after Ferguson and after Staten Island, they were the most conspicuous students in terms of organization and showing up. I think their level of frustration may actually have been higher than ours, because the narrative has been that the civil rights movement was victorious, that we were entering a new era. And so these murders have been particularly shocking, and then even more so the way the judicial system, the law enforcement system, has misfunctioned, if there's such a word. So I think that the energy is there. There may be more organized, different organizing ideas behind it than there were then. I think that we were talking about constitutional rights. We were talking about American democracy and the inconsistency and the contradiction of segregation and so on, which was the national civil rights narrative. Now there are many other voices. So it's in some ways more complicated than it was then.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, you've been associated with the university in excess of 50 years, and you've seen and understand its history. You've written about its history. You've analyzed it. What role do you see Howard University playing in today's society?
Well, Howard's role in many ways has been the same since it opened. That is, it's a transforming agent in the society. First, by providing an extraordinarily rich opportunity for students to become free in their own heads. I believe that the genius of Howard resides there. In some higher education systems, there's the idea of forming people into thinking a particular way. So when Napoleon created the French higher education system, it was to produce people who thought pretty much the same way, using the same thought processes, and they talked about formation. In the German system, they thought of it a little more organically, but it was the same concept. After their defeat by Napoleon, they developed this concept of Bildung, that a person, in effect, became cultivated and developed themselves, but it was still within certain parameters. Here, a student makes choices among several competing possibilities, and they then create themselves anew. It is true that the Howard graduate tends to be more independent, a freer thinker, and a good organizer.
And among those Howard graduates, you certainly epitomize all of those characteristics. So thanks for being here. My guest today has been the Provost and Chief Academic Officer of Howard University, Dr. Michael Winston. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Please join me next time on The Journey.
You've been listening to The Journey with Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, right here on the Howard University Radio Network.